hot bowl.
Hi, this is Lonnie Jordan, founding member of the band War, and I'm a big fan of KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles.
Welcome to Rising Up with Sona Ali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV and podcast platforms. On this show, you'll hear solutions journalism for social justice, fueling action, not despair. I'm Sona Ali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer. This week, I'll be on medical leave, and I'm bringing you a taped show with two inspiring book interviews from the Rising Up archives. First, we'll hear from philosophy professor Michael Brownstein, whose book is called Somebody Should Do Something: How Anyone Can Help Create Social Change. Professor Brownstein's hopeful view is that connecting with one another is in itself a radical act that can lead toward greater change. Then Jonathan Rosenblum, who worked as a staffer with Seattle's former socialist city councillor Kshama Sawant, will discuss his new book, We're Coming for You and Your Rotten System, How Socialists Beat Amazon and Upended Big City Politics. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Sona Ali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sona Ali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. We live in an age when fascism and authoritarianism are rising so fast, we're left feeling more helpless and disengaged each day. It's impossible for one person to make a difference, we tell ourselves. So we disconnect from reading the news to protect our own mental health, or consider moving to another country altogether to avoid fixing our own. But this sense of helplessness has been cultivated in an individualist society. Overcoming it takes work, but is eminently doable. In a new book called Somebody Should Do Something, authors Michael Brownstein, Alex Madva, and Danielle Kelly show how, quote, anyone can help create social change. Michael Brownstein now joins me. He's professor and chair of philosophy at John Jay College and professor of philosophy at the Graduate Center, CUNY. His earlier book was The Implicit Mind. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, and it's an honor to be here.
So let's first talk about what I mentioned, that this sense of individualist action and helplessness is cultivated, right? I mean, I don't know if it's uniquely American, but it is very American that we think of problems, issues, and even ideas and progress in individualist terms, that individuals did this or that or weren't able to do this or that, right? We don't really think of things in systems.
Yeah, that's right. So that's the jumping off place for the book, that we were raised with a message about how to make change that me and my co-authors all imbibed as kids, which is basically that there are good guys and bad guys in the world, and that the bad individuals cause the problems and the good individuals act like heroes and come along and vanquish them from time to time. It's suffused throughout our culture, from John Wayne and Horatio Alger, all the way up to our superhero movies today. But I think the more surprising thing is how suffused our concepts about social and political change are with an individualist ethos. So one of the sort of visualizations that we talk about in the book of that is a very famous public service announcement. It's usually called the Crying Indian ad, which came out in the very early days of the environmental movement in the early 70s. And you may have seen it, but if you haven't, I'll sort of just describe it for you really quickly. The camera opens to a Native American paddling down a river in a traditional canoe and traditional looking clothes. And there's a beating of the drum in the background, which kind of gets louder and faster as time goes on. And in the beginning, the scene is pristine. It looks like it could have been in a sort of pre-conquest time. But slowly you notice there's trash in the river, and then he pulls his canoe up to the bank, and you can see that the whole riverbank is strewn with trash. And he walks up onto the bank, and slowly you notice that he's right next to a highway, and someone opens their window and chucks a bag of trash out that lands at his feet. And the man turns and looks at the camera with a tear falling down his cheek, and an ominous-sounding narrator says, "People start pollution, and people can stop it." It was an incredibly effective ad. Some people credit it for really reducing roadside litter in the United States, which is a really good thing. I mean, all other things equal, I want to live in a cleaner world without trash on the side of the road. But the nefarious side of the story is that the ad was created by a group of executives from disposable packaging companies, from bottle and soda and chewing gum companies, who were basically trying to head off legislation that was being written in some states to hold them responsible for roadside litter. And so the thought was, well, let's make people feel like trash is their problem rather than put it on government to solve. And the message is crystal clear.
Or even corporations who are the ones kind of encouraging people,
Right. By government to solve, I mean passing laws that would force corporations to foot the bill. And so the message is brilliant because it sort of yokes one guilt, which is to say the white American conquest of Native Americans, to another guilt, which is despoiling the natural earth. And it tells you something you can do about it, right? You can manage that guilt by picking up some trash on the side of the road or throwing it in the recycling bin. And that message really worked. It caught fire. It was used in all kinds of other areas of life. Only you can prevent forest fires, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's really our inheritance. You see it in the climate movement as it matured. So we talk in the book also about Al Gore's famous documentary, An Inconvenient Truth, which is a great film. And it ends with a kind of, here's what you can do to fight the climate crisis. And the first bullet points are all these very solo, unsatisfying actions. Change your light bulbs, inflate your tires, et cetera. Which, again, are not bad things to do, like picking up litter, but there's no way they're going to make you feel satisfied if your concern is the climate crisis.
Right. And so you point out in your book that this message that individuals are responsible for solving big social systemic problems goes back a very long time in American culture. The trash picking one is a great example. You also point out cars and how the car industry basically held individuals responsible for fatalities on the road by suggesting, by creating a message that cars don't kill people, people do, which is, of course, very much the same message that Second Amendment advocates have really hammered into our culture, which is guns don't kill people, people do. And we're seeing that in the moment that you and I are speaking in, where gun violence is rampant all around us. And even when the victims include the supporters of gun rights, this idea that it's the individual behind the gun that we should be thinking about, not the weapon in their hand, is very powerful and very effective, but also imbibes us with a sense of helplessness, because to then make change requires millions, hundreds of millions of people doing the same individual action. And so why should one person's action or inaction make a difference? So that helplessness is really a big problem, right? That's the issue?
I mean, that's right. So I think the pervasive issue throughout American politics is people being bystanders, not getting involved. And so you could take that as a through line in the whole conversation. But really where we started was with a very personal experience, which you just spoke to, which is that if you think of yourself as just a drop in the bucket, then it feels like anything you do is relatively immaterial, that for us ordinary people, there's no chance to really affect meaningful change. And that's incredibly demotivating. And it's a problem that I think all three of us who wrote the book have felt pervasively throughout our lives. It then came to a point for us in our scholarship because we came to become familiar with all kinds of research, both in the domain of climate change, but also in all kinds of other areas, whether it's studying prejudice reduction or studying homelessness or whatever topic. We kind of came across this idea that these are systemic structural problems. They're problems that are built into the fabric of the way our social world is organized. And pair that with this sense of, I'm just a drop in the bucket. And then you really feel powerless because you say, okay, I got it. Throwing the milk jug into the recycling bin isn't going to do anything to address the systemic problem of climate change. What we need to do is change the fossil fuel industry or speed the energy transition. How do I know what to do about that, right? I don't have anything to do with the system itself. And so the goal of the book was really to bring the individual and the system together for people who already want to make change, but feel like they get that these are systemic problems, but that acts like a conversation stopper. It doesn't tell me what to do. In some ways, it only tells me what not to do.
Right. And another, I think, thing that also ends up happening is that people think of making change then as backing their favorite politician, because it's politicians who make elected officials who pass legislation. I'm very much, someone who feels ends up finding myself trapped in that thinking that if only we can get the right people into power, they're the ones who make change. And therefore, as an individual, the one thing I can do is go and canvas for my favorite politician or at the very least vote for my favorite politician and ask my friends to. That too is something that doesn't quite work very effectively, right? And can end up leading to disengagement.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, our book is about tools for thinking about social change. It's not a listicle or a how-to manual that says, here are the 3 or 5 or 10 most important actions. And so for most tools that people think about for making change, I usually say, excellent, do it. Like, whatever the thing is that you want to be doing, it's better than doing nothing. And so if canvassing or voting is what comes to mind for any given person, great, do that. Like, I think real change can come about when people vote in the right way. I don't think it's by any means exclusive, and there's lots of other things that people can be doing in addition. But what we're recommending is a change in perspective. So sticking with the voting example, it's very easy to think that my individual vote doesn't matter. I mean, again, just look at the numbers. Like, I'm just one drop in a really big bucket. That's so extreme that, in fact, a lot of the academic literature about voting motivation takes the problem from the other side, which is to say, why does anyone vote at all? Because the odds make it nearly irrational to do so, the chance of tipping an election, especially big national elections, for any one person is minuscule. when scholars look into this, what they find is that the reason people vote isn't because they actually think that they, with their one ballot, are going to tip the election. They do it because they feel a sense of connection or community to other people. They feel a sense of obligation to the norm of participating in the decision-making of their culture or their community or their country. And if you start thinking about those things, it becomes less about me as a solitary individual getting to pull the lever of historic change or not, and rather me being part of the fabric of a community and what kind of a community I want to be a part of and what kind of community member I want to be. And so that, at least when I think about whether I'm going to put in the effort to go vote, changes the question a little bit from, again, like, am I going to make all the difference, to what kind of a person I want to be? And I think the same lesson applies whether it's going to a protest or joining a union or even just trying to be a change maker at work. For whatever role one wants to play, there's a way of thinking oneself as part of a social community that I think is much more motivating than thinking of oneself as just an isolated atom in the big bucket of other atoms.
So how, what is history and maybe even human nature tell us about how changes have happened? I mean, very much historically speaking, we haven't had giant countries of hundreds of thousands of people. Society is generally organized around much smaller groupings. And so I think this is certainly, you know, a bit of a challenge when it comes to the long arc of history. But still, what does the history of humanity and human beings tell us about how we have historically thought about our role in society and our ability to affect change?
We have a chapter in the book about theories of human nature. And the main point we try to get across in that chapter is that both in a number of wisdom traditions outside of the European Western intellectual tradition, but also in a lot of the contemporary sciences of the mind, what you find is a picture of human nature that's much more radically social than I think many of us tend to think. That we are much more exposed to the influence of other people than we realize. And so one way you can think of that is that human beings are wired up by nature to be social, to be cultural. It sort of dissolves that old saw between nature and nurture, right? It's our nature to be nurtured by the people and the institutions and the culture around us. That's the sort of wisdom of, I think, the broad sciences of the mind and the social sciences these days. But like I said, predating it, many feminist traditions, many wisdom traditions from around the world have kind of gotten there way before our scientists have here nowadays. But what we try to do in the book is sort of turn that point on its head and draw a lesson out of it for making change. And one way to see what that lesson is that if all of us are far more exposed to influence from other people than we tend to realize, if the situations and the culture shape us more than we realize, that means that each of us has the opportunity to be the culture or the situation for some other person. In many ways, I am your situation, just as you are my situation. And we talk a lot about some really fascinating research from all different places that make that clear. So the number one predictor, the best way to predict who's going to quit smoking, for instance, is if their spouse quits smoking. A great way to predict who's going to vote is to look and see whether their roommate in college voted. Those are just two quick examples of what you might think of as peer influence. And you see evidence of it all over the place. Who puts solar panels on their roof? It's people when their neighbors put solar panels on their roof. And so one takeaway of that is that we are susceptible to social influence. But another takeaway is that we are potential purveyors of social influence. And that really comes right out of a picture of human nature that sees us as these deeply, deeply social creatures. We are in many ways outside in, as we say in the book.
That suggests to me that we're talking basically about the power of culture, of how, you know, of how we promote narratives, stories about how the world works, and just the act of, you know, each one of us is a promoter and purveyor of culture just from the conversations we have with our peers, right? Which suggests we have a lot more power than we think we do. And of course, it doesn't work as effectively to lecture at people. Sometimes that can backfire and can cause people to dig their heels in. So more of a doing by example, I think, is more effective. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a college professor, and we're probably more guilty than anyone for lecturing at people and wanting them to listen to what we think we know. But one of the real joys in writing this book was grounding it in storytelling and the stories throughout history of change makers, movement builders, some people who are heroic leaders, but some people who are really ordinary. So just one example that I found particularly fun to learn about and write about was Chris Smalls, who you may have heard of. He started off.
Yes, he's been a guest on our program recently. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's great. Okay. Well, so I probably don't need to tell your listeners his story, but I mean, briefly, the outline of it was, you know, that he grew up wanting to be a hip hop artist, and then he was aspiring to be an athlete, and he had a car accident. And he then had a kid, and so he was working a lot of odd jobs and ended up in an Amazon factory during the pandemic, and was outraged by the fact that the workers who were picking the packages weren't given adequate protective gear, and they staged a walkout. He was fired. He became a cause celeb because of a lot of racist tropes that people threw at him, that the head of the Amazon division that was handling this said, like, let's put this guy front and center because he dresses black and we think he'll sort of undermine the movement. And lo and behold, what he did was, you know, lead the first successful effort to unionize an Amazon warehouse. And one of the real key elements that we tried to draw out in the telling of his story was that he and his fellow organizers really focused on relationships. They were there every day at a table. They hung out in the break rooms. You know, there were group chats and social messaging boards online and so on, but they really reflected on those things as having comparatively less importance than just meeting people where they were, talking to them about their concerns, building trust, and creating solidarity that way. And so, you know, that's just one of the examples that we talk about in the book, but I thought an inspiring one.
Okay, so let's go back to what we started talking about, which is that the individualist way of looking at things is actually one that fosters helplessness. But what you and I are talking about right now is an individual. And, you know, how does that work then? If individuals feel helpless because we live in a society that uplifts individuals making change, then how is it that inspiring stories of individuals inspire change?
Yeah, good. So in some ways, the book is framed around like a pendulum swinging. And it was our observation that in recent decades, the progressive left has swung against individualism for all the good reasons that we were talking about before. And particularly in the last decade or so, driving for systemic structural change has been the name of the game. And we're on board with that. But what you hear sometimes is people saying, don't worry about individual choices, change the system instead. And it's the instead that is problematic, because where it leaves you is, okay, who's going to come along and change the system? Like, if not individuals, then who? And so what we depict is what we call a both and approach in the book, where one is constantly trying to attend to both the individual and the systemic sides of any problem. And they're always there. For any system, there are people who have to support it or oppose it. And for people, individuals, were always making choices within a culture, a set of institutions, a system that we may want to change. So one way to think about this is the question, how do you get individual people to care about structural change, whether it's the kinds of structural changes we need to address the climate crisis or to overcome racism or to combat income inequality, for whatever issue that is structural in nature, how do you get people to care about it and to effectively mobilize against it and to work together to change it? So here's one example that we haven't yet talked about. Kids grow up with ideas about individual responsibility versus systemic responsibility. There's really fascinating research in developmental psychology trying to understand why some kids understand social structures in one way and other kids understand them in other ways, what leads some kids to find them unjust when they are, and what leads some kids to find them permissible, or in other words, to display a kind of bias toward the status quo. And so, like, just one example that we talk about in the book is some research that shows that when that basically all kids are really good at seeing that there are hierarchies between groups that go beyond any one individual. They see the structures, but they understand them differently. And what predicts when kids see a group-based difference as unjust is their parents' attitudes towards those group differences. And so there's an opportunity to be a change maker, right? To capitalize on one's role as a parent, to teach one's kids about group-based differences, about injustices that are baked into the fabric of our society, and so on. So we don't shy away in the book from the idea of individual responsibility or individual action. It's the idea that we want to turn those actions away from the ones that just assuage our guilt or continue to make us think that we're just isolated atoms, and turn them toward structural change-making activities that build community, that work towards transformations in society.
So how to put this into action? Let's talk about the action part of this conversation around how change actually happens. Are there effective examples of the ways in which change is happening now that you can point to? You refer to the climate movement, and you do write about it more extensively in the book than we discussed, which was one that had initially been rooted in individualist actions. Is the modern day climate movement doing better? Are there other movements that you can point to say there is a movement that seems to be creating change by focusing both on individual and group actions?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's any formula out there, right? If there was, it would have been discovered. But there are certainly lots of examples of successful movements over time that have had a both and kind of approach, which is to say they have taken people as they are, they've motivated them, they've brought them together, and then they've worked over time to create and implement change. I'll tell you one brief story again that we go into in much greater detail in the book, and it's a story of two movements, both of which I don't actually subscribe to, right? Whose goals I disagree with, but I think it's valuable to learn from. So one is the temperance movement in the United States, which culminated in prohibition. The temperance movement worked doggedly for decades to persuade Americans about the evils of alcohol. And in many cases, for lots of good reason, the temperance movement was led mostly by women, and it was led by women who were the victims of domestic violence. And in fact, during the brief period of prohibition, domestic violence went down precipitously in the United States. One of the key things that the ASL, the Anti-Saloon League, did during their activism was create a kind of identity around their goal. They had all kinds of social activities, cultural products, ways of helping people feel like they belonged to a group whose mission was to ultimately get rid of alcohol in the United States. That was powerful because what it enabled them to do was persuade politicians that they had a large block of reliable voters who you either had to take seriously and that those voters would then support you, or if you ignored, you ignored them at your own peril. Now, prohibition ultimately failed because Americans ultimately didn't like it, right? It had all kinds of problems. And so it was a great example of successful change, but not change that lasts. And just as a sidebar, one of the main things we emphasize in the book and have a chapter on is the importance of focusing on implementation of change, not just starting it. But the second example that I'll tell you is one that learned a lot from the temperance movement, which is the NRA. So this is relevant, of course, to today, where we're seeing political violence and school shootings and gun violence all over the place. And a lot of that, as you sort of alluded to before, has to do with just how many guns are out there. And a lot of that has to do with the legislative and cultural successes of the NRA. And again, just to make it very clear, I very much wish they had not been successful, but right. I do think it's worthwhile to learn the lessons of what made them successful. And what the NRA did was very similar to the temperance movement in the sense that they capitalized on the motivating power of group identity. They created a culture around gun rights where people would put that at the top of their list of what they cared about politically and what they would vote on. They might compromise on the 9 other items on their list of what they want to see a politician do, but if you're against them on gun rights, they would never vote for you. And they did that in all kinds of really clever ways. The ultimate result was an incredibly reliable and motivated block of engaged voters. The climate movement did a lot of work to learn the lessons from the NRA, and I think they were instrumental in passing the Inflation Reduction Act and the various other legislative achievements that we saw in the Biden administration, precisely because they learned those lessons. And the fact that right now the climate movement in the United States feels more adrift, the fact that we're awash in guns, I mean, these are terrible, terrible things that are ominous, but I don't think it invalidates the lessons from those movement builders over time.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Michael Brownstein. I'm sure people can get the fuller picture by picking up a copy of your book and reading it themselves. Thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
My guest has been Michael Brownstein, professor and chair of philosophy at John Jay College and a professor of philosophy at the Graduate Center, CUNY. He's the author of The Implicit Mind, and we've been talking about his new book, co-authored with Alex Madva and Daniel Kelly, called Somebody Should Do Something, How Anyone Can Help Create Social Change. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. Our interviews are available to subscribers at risingupwithsonali.com. There was a time when socialists were so rare in elected office in the United States, most people could only cite Bernie Sanders, maybe even Eugene Debs, as having had power. Today, more people are proudly wearing the mantle of socialist as capitalism's failures become ever apparent. And for that, we can thank not just the likes of Sanders, but Kshama Sawant, who is arguably far bolder than the Vermont senator. When Sawant, an Indian immigrant, burst into the local political scene in Seattle, Washington, running for city council on an overtly anti-capitalist agenda, many people, including my next guest, were initially skeptical. Jonathan Rosenblum has helped workers throughout North America organize, bargain, and strike in a wide range of industries, warehousing and logistics, higher education, healthcare, and public service. And during Kshama Sawant's decade on the city council in Seattle, he worked on her council staff, as well as an election campaigner. And he now joins me to discuss his new book, We're Coming for You and Your Rotten System, How Socialists Beat Amazon and Upended Big City Politics. Welcome to the program, Jonathan.
Thank you, Sonali, and thank you for having me on.
So I said that you were initially skeptical, and that's how you start your book. You were skeptical of Sawant because she showed up to an event, a rally for SeaTac airport workers who, more than a decade ago, we're lobbying for, we're pushing for a $15 an hour minimum wage. Lay out that scene for us where you first encountered Kshama Sawant and how she struck you, how her brand of politics struck you, initially with a little fear, and then you came around.
Yeah, this was my first encounter with Kshama and the organization that she had belonged to at the time, Socialist Alternative, and they came down to SeaTac, Washington, 15 miles south of Seattle in 2013, where airport workers were fighting to get an initiative on the ballot there for a $15 minimum wage, which they were successful at doing, and they were successful in winning a few months later. And Kshama spoke at this public hearing and, compared to the other speakers who are very modest and moderate in their tone, seeking to persuade a fairly conservative electorate in SeaTac to vote for this transformative wage increase for airport workers, Kshama held nothing back and talked about the maladies of capitalism and why we needed to fight not just the corporations, but the mainstream political parties, both the Republicans and the Democrats, who are holding workers back. And I was really, frankly, a little bit askance at the sharpness of her tone. But then after the meeting, just talking to the airport workers who were there about who they liked hearing from at the hearing, everyone said to a person, "We like that Indian lady from Seattle." And I realized that Kshama had tapped a core emotion, energy that workers had, that they'd been screwed time and again by the system. They'd been handed foreclosure notes and layoff slips and everything, while Wall Street got bailed out after the, in 2009 with the Great Recession. And they saw how the rich people made out like bandits and working people got screwed. And they resonated with the message that Kshama said, that it is time to stand up and fight. And that really began, for me, a decade of work with Kshama and with members of Socialist Alternative and now her new organization, Workers Strike Back, in winning bold transformative wins in Seattle. And these are instructive. How we won, how we struggled and won, is very instructive to how we need to fight in the political arena today.
So let's talk about that. There has been traditionally this coalition, especially in so-called blue cities, of liberal elected officials with big business who have, give paid lip service to social issues, paid lip service to even left issues, and generally maybe very slowly ushered in reforms that haven't often resulted in progress, sometimes actually resulted in regression. And Seattle was subject to the same thing. We see that sort of thing happening in progressive cities all over the country too, right? San Francisco and Portland and LA and Chicago and New York City. And how did Kshama Sawant's rhetoric, and not just her rhetoric, but her organizing, show that actually that liberal coalition with big business was the problem, not just a hindrance, but the problem?
Right. The, you know, coalitions like that, which you're describing, or attempts to work within the Democratic Party, are political dead ends for working people. And there are three things that Sciamma and the socialists around her did that were fundamentally different from what we're seeing today with contemporary socialist people in DSA even. And those three things are: one is we had a class struggle approach, two is that we made bold demands, and three is that we practiced movement democracy. And if I may, I want to just break those down a little bit, because it's important to understand the very systematic approach that Sciamma took in these struggles. That first of all, we understood that in going into political office in Seattle City Council, we were not all of a sudden the friends of the Democrats on City Council. And Seattle is a, you know, it's a Democratic run city. There's 9 City Council members. There were 8 Democrats. And then there was Sciamma, the representative of Socialist Alternative. And we understood that when we took on that position, we were seen as an adversary inside the political establishment's home. We were indeed an enemy inside their camp, and they did everything they could to marginalize us, box us out, and that we realized that in order to win, we had to build movements from the outside, and then we had to use the council office as an organizing base for the working class to fight for 15 as a minimum wage, to fight for transformative renters' rights legislation, and ultimately to fight for a tax on Amazon to build social housing. And we were successful in all of these fights and more because we understood that everything within city government was part of this capitalist construct that was designed specifically to maintain the status quo. So we would have to fight the legislature, we'd have to fight the mayor's office, we'd have to fight in the courts, we'd have to fight the bureaucracy and the media and the two main establishment parties if we were to win. And we could only do that by creating outside movements. That's one. The second thing is bold demands. We made bold demands because, first of all, working people need bold transformative change. And secondly, we knew that in order to mobilize people, we had to make demands that would transform people's lives. We know that, you might recall that almost a generation ago, when Barack Obama was president, you know, he proposed a $10.10 minimum wage. Well, that went nowhere, right? It went nowhere because 10-10 does not change people's lives. 15 was bare minimum back in 2013, but that was a huge increase for workers, and they realized that if we can win 15, we can have better lives. The other reason why we made bold demands is that we wanted to demonstrate to working people the inability of capitalism and the political establishment to meet our basic needs, and the need to have a broader fight, not just for the material things that we were fighting for, but for broad systemic change. And so we put forward these demands as a way of showing what we needed, but also why we needed to change the system by fighting for a socialist future and not trying to just exist within the capitalist parties that are being offered to us. And then finally, we practiced movement democracy, which means that every step of the way, working people were consulted formally and informally in the creation of demands and in the advancement of strategies to win those demands. So, for instance, the demand to tax Amazon to build social housing was a demand that came out of several different conferences that we had on consecutive Saturdays in early 2020, where working people came together by the hundreds in a meeting room and sat down and figured out, what should we be demanding? How do we shape those demands? What are the strategies and tactics that we use to make to advance that call for taxing Amazon? And that is how the Tax Amazon movement was built, through popular movement democracy. And everyone who came to those meetings, whether they were a grizzled veteran in struggle or somebody coming to a political meeting for the first time, everybody had exactly one vote.
I want to ask you about how a lot of liberal leaders have managed to sort of hobble and neutralize even people on the left who have very bold sounding policies by their so-called big tent approach and how Kshama Sawant navigated that. It's often the case where whenever we're talking about, you know, anything like raising a wage or closing down on, you know, or having police accountability, for example, the liberal mayors will form a commission and invite you to be on it and then invite all stakeholders. They love the sort of language, bringing all stakeholders to the table. And Kshama Sawant also encountered that. How did she navigate that?
Yeah, it's a great question, Sonali. And I would say that everywhere in politics at the local, state, and federal levels, you see these sort of efforts to divert away from worker democracy into these other processes that are behind closed doors, where workers really don't have access, where there's a complete lack of transparency about what happens. And in the end, you know, a lot of these times you see politicians hold a press conference and they say, you know, we've all reached consensus. We've got this this wonderful agreement. We're going to move forward with this legislation. But because working people were excluded from the true discussions where decisions were made, it doesn't meet our needs. And so we see this time and again. And Kshama broke through these sort of these techniques that the political establishment uses, frankly, to isolate the rest of us from these political decisions by forcing debates into the open, by holding community forums where workers could, again, as I mentioned, discuss and decide how we were going to approach things. When the $15 minimum wage fight reached ahead in early 2014, after Kshama took office, after her remarkable election the previous fall, the mayor set up a minimum wage commission called the Income Inequality Advisory Commission, designed to create some consensus around what the minimum wage should be. And on this commission were union leaders, business leaders who were vehemently opposed to any increase in the minimum wage, and some other civic leaders. Of the 25 members of this commission, not a single one was a minimum wage worker. Now, the mayor had to appoint Kshama to the commission because she had been the leader of the fight for 15 in the previous months. And when she agreed to do it, she said, I'm only going to do it with a couple of understandings. First of all, I am a shop steward on this commission for the working class. And secondly, she said, I will not be bound by any internal commission agreements about secrecy, about not sharing information, right? I am a conduit to the working class on this commission. I am their representative, and I'm going to work very closely with people in the community to make sure that our voices are heard and that we're not boxed out. And that was very disruptive to the normal procedure in Seattle around these sort of closed door meetings that that result in consensus agreements that don't meet our needs. But that was just one of the ways in which we broke through that sort of model of political establishment governance.
There's also a really interesting aspect to Kshama Sawant's story and her time on the city council, in that she became a lightning rod for liberal politicians who didn't like her style and, you know, fixated on her brash manner and really formed these unholy alliances with big business, with companies like Amazon, to fund big recalls against her, to force recounts, to really, really challenge her. We're seeing some of this happening in New York City right now with Zohran Mamdani running for mayor, where Andrew Cuomo is meeting with real estate developers, and all these sort of alliances between people who claimed to have at one point been liberal, aligning with right-wing and corporate forces to defeat somebody whose message is resonant with the majority of voters. So tell me about the maligning she faced. It can't have been easy for her or her staff, right?
Interesting thing about Kshama, she always said, it's not personal. And she really did mean that when she was attacked, and she certainly faced tremendous threats, and we were certainly excoriated in the mainstream press multiple times, the editorialists absolutely detested Shama and everything she was fighting for. But she was very clear in speaking to working people that this is not personal. They are attacking me because they are attacking our movement, because they are against the things that we're fighting for. That the reason why the big developers are attacking me personally is because they know that when we pass these renter rights bills, they are going to have to pay more attention to renters' rights. They are going to have to throttle back on their rent increases. They are going to have to do business differently. So it's never personal from our standpoint. And I think there, you mentioned the New York race, and I want to point out there are two things, two dynamics that are going on. One certainly is this alliance between members of the political establishment, the Democratic Party, and big business in lining up with Cuomo. That is certainly a feature of what happens when you have an insurgent candidate who is threatening the political establishment. But the other dynamic, Sonali, is that you're seeing an attempt at co-optation of Mamdani by sectors of the political establishment. So you have the governor of New York endorsing Mamdani. You have other mainstream Democrats endorsing Mamdani. You have Mamdani agreeing to meet with the police and, you know, water down his statements that he's issued before about the role of racist police in our capitalist society. You see Mamdani being pulled by these consultants he's hired, consultants who've worked for mainstream Democrats, being pulled to the center on a number of issues, right? And that is in some ways more insidious even than the alliance between Cuomo and big business, because it's that co-optation that is going to seek in the long run to neuter the movement in New York. And it is something that people need to be paying close attention to and fighting back against.
When we look at the legacy that Sawant leaves behind, in, not just in Seattle, but nationwide, what do you think needs to stick in people's minds? Because first of all, she's made it. She just, in, I remember when it was a political earthquake. Oh my goodness, Seattle just elected a socialist to their city council. I remember that, you know, over about a decade ago being this important, powerful thing. And now it's become less out of the ordinary. There are a growing numbers of people who openly identify as socialists running for city council, running for school board, running for Congress even. And I'm wondering if you see that as part of Shama's legacy and also what you hope that people take outside of the label of socialist, because it's not just the label of socialist that's important, but that inside approach to governance that literally brings the movement into the halls of power with you, right?
I wrote the book, We're Coming for You and Your Rotten System, How Socialists Beat Amazon and Upended Big City Politics, because it's important to me as an organizer. You can't just wage the fight. Then you have to tell the story of what we won and how we won so you can teach future organizers and working people how to fight their battles today. Right. And so it's important to talk about the lessons. There are, as you've noted, a number of people who call themselves socialists in the political world today in this country and in other countries. But I wanted to draw out the lesson in the book about the fundamental different methods and approach that Shama used compared to what we see with Bernie, with AOC, even with Mamdani today, that she by taking these three principles are what I call the three pillars of Marxist insurgent struggle. We built a different kind of political battle than what we're seeing other socialists take on, because we took a class struggle approach, because we made bold demands, and because we practiced movement democracy, we won these things. So I think even more than the actual policy wins that we achieved in Seattle in the last decade, I hope people look at the methods and strategies that we employed, because that will be more instructive to them about how to fight in their own communities today. Now, Shama is no longer in city council. She left after 10 years, undefeated, I might add. And now she is running for Congress against Adam Smith, who is one of the top proponents of the U.S.-backed Israeli genocide on the Palestinian people. He's never seen a war he hasn't liked. He's been in Congress for 28 years, and we are girding up to take him on in 2026. And I can tell you that working people are super excited here in the Seattle area to see Adam Smith get unseated, because he deserves to go. And I would say also for people listening to and watching your program, join this fight. The new organization that we built in the last couple of years following Shama's leaving council office is Workers Strike Back. You can join us at workersstrikeback.org. Please get involved. We're fighting for free healthcare. We're fighting to get rid of genocider Adam Smith. We're fighting for workers' rights, and we're fighting to build a new political order in this country.
You intend for your book to be a blueprint, and does it contain advice for people seeking to run for office right now at smaller offices than Congress? You know, I imagine that one of the things that we haven't gotten to yet, and I just want to end on this question, is that it wasn't just Shama coming in. She was a very eloquent a spokesperson for a movement that had already existed, right? A socialist alternative. Do you advise people seeking office who want this bold anti-capitalist socialist agenda to really connect up with local organizers, to have that sort of base that Shama Sawant did in Seattle with Socialist Alternative?
Yeah, and I would say the book does not offer a recipe. This is not a formulaic approach to political struggle, but it offers some methods and principles, and the three that I've outlined. And it also, Sonali, I spend a lot of time in the book really telling the story about these struggles through the eyes of workers themselves, many of whom were socialist, many of whom were not. But they got involved in the fight because they saw through the leadership that Shama offered that this was a different way through to fight for things in the political arena. And in fact, it was a way not just to fight, but to win. So I hope that people read the book, which you can get at orbooks.com. That's orbooks.com. And look at the methods that we employed and also the stories, because it is important for people to understand, yes, we absolutely need the strong leadership that Shama and others around her provided, but we also need to recognize the genius, the creativity, the energy, the inventiveness of people at the grassroots doing the day-to-day work, which is not in the spotlight, the door knocking, talking at union meetings, going to churches and mosques and having individual conversations with people, walking the streets and knocking on doors and talking with people or tabling. It's that sort of day-to-day organizing that builds a movement too, in addition to the strong leadership that we had.
And we'll post a link to that website for Orbooks, where people can get a hold of the book we've just been discussing. Jonathan, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and best of luck to you. We'll certainly be following Shama Sawant's race for Congress. We've had her on this program many times before. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Jonathan Rosenblum, a labor organizer, election campaigner, former city council staffer for Shama Sawant in Seattle. He's the author of We're Coming for You and Your Rotten System: How Socialists Beat Amazon and Upended Big City Politics. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms. We'll be right back.
is Donna Walker, host of Pacifica Performance Showcase here on KPFK. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in, and especially thank those of you who pledged your support or renewed your membership to KPFK during this past fund drive. The support of generous listeners like you is what allows this listener-sponsored station to operate and to maintain its fierce independence. It's a very special relationship, so thank you once again for being a part of it.
You're invited to tune in to The QR Code with your hosts, Ramses Jha and Q Ward.
The Q in The QR Code goes by the name of Q Ward.
The voice you just heard is the R in The QR Code. He goes by the name Ramses Jha.
Every Monday through Thursday at 6 a.m., KPFK's own Global Village host, Kevin Lincoln,